This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. The new film, Never Look Away, is about an artist, a painter, who's first exposed to modern art as a child growing up in Nazi Germany. He's taken by his aunt to an exhibit of modern art that was curated by the Nazis to show what degenerate art looks like, the kind of art the Nazis are banning. By the time the boy is an art student, the Russian communists have taken over East Germany, where the boy lives, and all art is expected to be propaganda, showing images of happy working people. As a young man, he flees to West Germany and attends an art school known to be avant-garde. The artists there consider representational painting, the kind of painting he does, to be obsolete. Implicit in the movie are questions like, why make art? What is art for, and who is it for? The movie is inspired by the life of Gerhard Richter, one of the most famous German painters of his generation. My guest is the film's writer and director, Florian Henkel von Donnersmarck. His 2006 film, The Lives of Others, won an Oscar for Best Foreign Language Film. That film was set in East Germany, about a playwright and an officer of the Stasi, the state secret police, who spies on the playwright. The new film, Never Look Away, was nominated for an Oscar. Florian Henkel von Donnersmarck, welcome to Fresh Air. The film starts with an exhibit of degenerate art. It's Dresden, 1937. The Nazis have taken power in Germany. And this was an exhibit that actually happened in Nazi Germany when non-representational modern art was considered a threat. It was considered subversive. It was considered a sign of mental illness. Tell us what you know about this exhibit of degenerate art.
Mm-hmm. You know, it was one of the most successful exhibits ever staged. Over 2 million people came to see the exhibit, and it was the German government, Goebbels, going into the individual museums, he and his people, and finding art that they considered didn't match the aesthetic ideals of Nazi Germany. So anything that didn't show beautiful, realistic landscapes and people, anything that they didn't consider uplifting, was pulled out. And the least craft-like of those artworks were shown in this exhibit for people to make fun of. And in a time of great poverty in Germany, they would put next to each artwork a number of marks that it had cost. So they said, oh, you know, this individual painting here, which only consists of lines and blotches or a blue horse or something ridiculous like that, a guy who can't even get the color of a horse right, was paid 2,000 marks for this painting at times where you guys are all starving. It was supposed to really create a hatred of people who didn't toe the party line in arts in Germany. And I think, you know, many people did see it that way. But one thing that you also find in the biographies of some artists is that many people used it as a last chance to see great and free art, because this was amazing art. And then actually after that exhibit was done, and over 2 million people had seen it, the Nazis sold what they could in Switzerland, and the rest they destroyed. So a lot of these paintings were actually destroyed. And I always felt that was such a massive cultural loss. And so our painters worked with the archives of these persecuted painters to try and reconstruct the paintings that were shown in that exhibit. So we rebuilt them from little black and white photographs, trying to figure out what colors people had used. And so we really made all those artworks come to life again. So actually, you know, although it's a fairly short scene and just the first few minutes of the movie, it was actually a very complicated production.
Because you had to make all the art.
We had to make the art, and actually now we have to destroy this art. The crazy agreement that we have with the collecting society is that after we're done filming, so they don't suddenly appear somewhere as forgeries, we actually have to destroy them again. So I haven't yet found in myself the strength to do it, so they're still in my mom's cellar in Berlin. But at some point I'm going to have to go down there and destroy them.
Why is it so hard for you to destroy? I mean, they're fakes.
Yeah, but they're as close to the real thing as we have, and that's also why they have to be destroyed, because in 50 years' time, someone could find them and think, oh, great, here's Otto Dix's War Cripples. It wasn't destroyed after all. Here's the real thing, and suddenly you have a forgery in circulation, and that's why they want it destroyed. But, you know, I still feel that, I know there's something, these paintings have been destroyed once before. Now we've reconstructed them with great love, and now we have to destroy them again. It's a little sad.
What really just strikes me as so odd about the Nazi degenerate art exhibit, I mean, and there were very famous artists in there. I think Picasso was in there, right? And Kandinsky and Paul Klee. How crazy is it to warn people about how horrible this art is when it's like great art and you're exposing people to it who never would have seen it otherwise?
No, it really is one of the crazy, crazy chapters in art history, I mean, in human history, all of everything having to do with what the Nazis did. When these, for example, the Expressionists between the two world wars showed the crime and depravity and despair that was in Germany and made paintings of, prostitutes in terrible living conditions and of murders and of war cripples, the Nazis said, oh, well, look, this is what these artists want for our country. This is what they consider beautiful. This is how deranged these people are, that is actually their agenda for Germany, when, of course, they were... This was a cry of sorrow and despair. So it's so interesting that they could not even imagine that other people had a completely different philosophy. Not only did they persecute people who thought differently, they couldn't even imagine what it was that led to those different thoughts.
But, the thing that you have to say, too, about the degenerate art exhibition is that it showed that the Nazis thought art was really powerful and that power had to be banned when it
Very
was in
true.
The hands of artists who they considered, deranged or mentally ill or not
so
politically
true.
Correct, to put it in today's
yes.
terms. And it's instilling a lot of power in art when a lot of people are so indifferent to art, they wouldn't have cared one way or another.
No, I mean, I think that's one thing that you find... I mean, in all dictatorships that I've looked at, I find that they have exactly what you're talking about, this fundamental belief that art is something that has to be kept under control. And I thought for a long time, why do these primitive people take art so seriously? It's the last thing that they care about. But I think that in their incredible survival instinct, these dictators know that art has the power to change the way that people see the world. I mean, I've almost come to find that that's the definition of art.
Well, a contrast that you make and a similarity that you draw is, the Nazis are trying to ban art and control art and keep art to, like, realistic, uplifting paintings. And the World War II ends, and then the Russians move in, take over East Germany, and it's very similar. And so the main character, the artist in your movie, first he sees the German, the Nazi exhibit of decadent art. And then as he becomes an art student, the only thing you're allowed to paint is, like, uplifting things in service of, like, the people with capital letters. And instead of, for instance, like a nude model for the art students to draw to learn anatomy, they're drawing a man and a woman. One of them's holding a sickle and the other has a handful of wheat because they're showing, like, the people working in the fields, And so, like, you're... they're in opposition, the Nazis and the communists. They were at war together, the Russians and the Germans, but their attitude toward art is pretty much the same.
Yeah, it's really interesting. I think as soon as you try and control art, art disappears. And the Nazis had this terrible philosophy of art, and then the communists came to power and said, well, look, we're going to do things all differently from the Nazis. And actually now, if you look at some of the Nazi paintings and some of the communist paintings, it's almost hard to tell the difference. And they were so convinced they were doing the exact opposite, but what they were doing was just keeping tight control on art and thereby destroying it.
So your movie Never Look Away is inspired by the life of the German artist Gerhard Richter, who developed a style of, like, photorealism in which the realism was, I don't know what word to use, a little mottled, a little distorted in the final part of the process. But he has objected to the film. Apparently, you interviewed him for many hours. And once the film came out, he did his best to distance himself from it, saying things like, it's
Well, he hasn't seen it.
I mean,
he hasn't seen it. He didn't like the trailer. That was what I showed him. He didn't like that because he felt it was, you know, kind of too loud or so. I mean, I really tried to get him to see the film. I said, you know, you can't you can't judge a film based on its trailer. I mean, I kept him informed every step of the way. Even read him the script when I was done with it. So, but I'd been warned by his biographer that he always turns on people after opening up to them. The same thing had happened to the biographer, so I was a little bit prepared. I thought it wouldn't really happen to me because I just kept him informed every step of the way, but it did happen. I think it's too bad he didn't see the film, but in a way I also understand him because it's about a lot of traumatic things, many of which have happened in his life also. And if I put myself in that position, quite honestly, of thinking, okay, I'm offered by someone to relive the greatest trauma of my life on screen, you know, I don't know if I would want that. You know, would I maybe want to talk through those things with someone who was really interested in and interested in getting to the truth of my feelings? Yes, probably yes. So, you know, maybe the film is for everybody except for him.
So your movie Never Look Away is inspired by the life of the German artist Gerhard Richter. Richter's aunt was killed by the Nazis, and as the aunt is depicted in the film, and you could tell us if this was similar mm-hmm. in real life, she suffered from schizophrenia.
Mm-hmm. Could have been schizophrenia or a form of bipolar disorder. I mm-hmm. mean, all her medical records are still there, but it's not completely clear which of those two illnesses it was.
And at the time, the Nazis had a program in which if you were not considered fit for reproduction because of any kind of, mental health issue, whether they thought that you were mentally deficient cognitively or if you had like a mental illness like bipolar or schizophrenia, they would sterilize you so that you couldn't reproduce and ruin the German bloodline. And then often they would kill you afterwards just to make like double sure that you didn't infect Germany. And so you have this happen to her. Did you do a lot of research into this forced sterilization?
Oh, goodness, yeah. I mean, it was mm-hmm. that was really a very depressing chapter of this. And, you know, it only takes up a small part of the film, but it was an important premise. I mean, I took the whole crew to the place where these people were murdered, for instance. You know, it's a research center now, and there are wonderful historians researching this. Also, I mean, it number-wise, of course, it doesn't approach anything of the murders that came later, where the Nazis ended up, you know, committing the greatest history of mankind and murdering the Jewish people. But this was a little bit of a, you know, like a miniature dress rehearsal for that. They actually developed a lot of the techniques which were then later used in the Holocaust. They developed those in targeting those who were, you know, mentally disabled. And also discovered through this that they had to completely keep everything in the hands of the SS. And when there was a lot of protest against this murdering of people with these hereditary mental disabilities, and they had to officially shut it down. Of course, unofficially it went on, but then they realized, okay, it's not enough to have it in the furthest eastern corner of the Reich. We have to actually move it further east, and moved it into Poland and put everything in the hands of the SS when they went on to what their main goal was, the murder of Jewish people.
So the gas chamber was one of the things that was started for people with mental illness?
Yes, that's where they developed all the techniques, even the exact, you know, crematoria and all that. It's something which has only been being researched now, but there's a government-funded research center there at Pirna-Sonnenstein, and we had all the historians work on our film, and we reconstructed those things exactly. And when we shot that one kind of really tough scene of the murder, we actually had those historians there, and we shot it on the day of the remembrance of the victims of the crimes of the Nazis, and said, "Look, let's build a monument to these victims."
You wrote the first draft of your first film, The Lives of Others, at a Cistercian monastery in the Vienna woods, where your uncle mm-hmm. is the emeritus abbot. And my understanding is that this is an order that practices silence, and I imagine there's a lot of, it sounds like it's a pretty cloistered, you know, monastery, and I'm sure there's like some, you know, chanting or meditation involved.
All the time.
Mm-hmm. So what was it like for you to write a film there, and were you, did you observe the silences and meditate and pray with the monks?
Well, it's really a beautiful and magical place, this monastery that was founded in the 12th century and has existed in the exact same way right to the present day. And there has not been a day since, what was it, I think, 1190 or something like that, where you did not have the exact same routine every single day. Actually, it almost died under the Nazis. They had arrested every single one except one of the monks, but he still kept that going. And then right after the Nazis were driven out, it all came back to full power. So there's an incredible power about the continuity of that observance there. And nothing has changed about the way that they live in those 850 years. And it's really a perfect place to work. I was given a monk's cell, and all these guys do is work and pray. And no, I didn't pray with them during the time that I was writing it there. But sometimes I did go to the Gregorian chanted prayer. But I said, you know, my prayer is going to be writing this screenplay, and my work is going to be writing this screenplay. But at least I won't be completely alone. You know, I'll get the food that the monks eat there. Monks eat quite well, or at least a lot, because they don't have that many other sensual pleasures that they can engage in. So very few of them are actually, lean. So I enjoyed that part, since I'm not all that lean myself. And it was a very good place to write. You know, there are just no distractions. You can't go to, I don't know, this dinner party or to, I don't know, that interesting exhibition, because there's truly nothing there. And it was a perfect way to focus. I recommend it to anyone. If you know a Cistercian somewhere, they actually have to. The great thing is, it's part of the rule of St. Benedict that they have to take in guests. So if you go there and say, hey, will you invite me? They have to say yes. So they're very generous and very nice people. And hospitality is part of their code. So they will take you in. So if any of you want to write a symphony or a screenplay or a novel or just your dissertation, then go to a Benedictine monastery now.
You think that's better than a writer's colony?
I've never tried a writer's colony, but I could imagine that there would be some kind of, I don't know, you know, let's say competition or dynamics or who's more important, or, you know, is this person writing more than I am? In a monastery, you know, they're all praying more than you're writing, so you've been outdone from moment one anyway.
All right. It's been so great to talk with you, and congratulations on your film.
Oh, well, thank you very much, Terry. I really enjoyed our conversation. Thanks.
Florian Henkel van Donnersmarck wrote and directed the new film Never Look Away. Has Fox News crossed the line from partisan to propaganda? That's what Jane Mayer investigates in her new article titled The Making of the Fox News White House, published in The New Yorker, where she's a staff writer. She says the White House and Fox News interact so seamlessly that it can be hard to determine during a news cycle which one is following the other's lead. One of the stories she uncovered involves President Trump's attempt to get the Justice Department to stop a business deal that would be unfavorable to Fox. This revelation might lead to a congressional investigation. She reports that during the 2016 presidential campaign, Fox killed a story because it would have hurt Trump's chances of winning. Mayer also writes about Trump's relationship with Rupert Murdoch, the chair of Fox News, and about the revolving door between Fox and the Trump White House. We recorded our interview Wednesday. It was first broadcast on Fresh Air Thursday. And as we record this weekend edition on Friday, Bill Shine has just resigned his position as Deputy White House Chief of Staff overseeing communications. Shine had epitomized the revolving door. He's a former co-president of Fox News. He'll now be working on Trump's re-election campaign. Another development since we recorded the interview, the chair of the Democratic National Committee, Tom Perez, issued a statement that the New Yorker's reporting on the inappropriate relationship between President Trump, his administration, and Fox News led Perez to conclude that Fox is not in a position to host a fair and neutral debate for Democratic candidates and therefore would not serve as a debate host for the 2020 Democratic primary debates. So here's an excerpt of the interview I recorded Wednesday with Jane Mayer. Jane Mayer, welcome back to Fresh Air. So let me ask you about the story in your piece that's made the most news, and that's that President Trump tried to order the Justice Department to file a lawsuit to stop AT&T from acquiring Time Warner. Explain what Trump did.
So this was in the late summer of 2017, and Trump ordered Gary Cohn, who was then the head of the National Economic Council, so the top economic advisor in the White House, he ordered him to get the Justice Department to file suit and stop the deal. And President Trump, it was an Oval Office meeting. Trump said, block that deal. I want it blocked. I've told you 50 times. We need to get that suit filed. So you could see that the president was actually trying to interfere in the Justice Department's decision about one of the biggest deals involving billion-dollar companies that have to do with news organizations.
So Gary Cohn declined to do that, right? Then what happened?
Well, so Gary Cohn turned to John Kelly, who had just become chief of staff, on the way out. The two of them were walking out of the Oval Office, and he turned to Kelly and said, don't you dare do that. This is not how we're going to do business. But what was interesting to me also was just a couple months later, the Justice Department did intervene in that case, filed a suit, and tried to block the deal. And it's since lost that case, but they really did get into it.
So how does this story fit into your story about the relationship between the Trump administration and Fox News?
It's an example of a pattern that you can see, which is that many decisions that have to do with regulatory matters seem to favor Fox News and its chairman, Rupert Murdoch. And that was one of the deals that took place that seemed to favor Rupert Murdoch. And it's, if you bear with me for 1 second, the reason is that Time Warner owns CNN, and CNN is the rival of Fox News. And so by blocking that deal when the Justice Department got in, it really tried to hurt Time Warner and CNN by doing that. And it cost them hundreds of millions of dollars by filing that suit. So it was a matter that was very helpful to Rupert Murdoch, and it also was very hurtful to CNN, who President Trump has been, you know, very open about disparaging.
Right. So President Trump sees CNN as one of the kings of fake news, and he's very much, and he very, very much has a good relationship with Rupert Murdoch and Fox News.
So he's got a very close relationship with Rupert Murdoch. I mean, this is one of the things that I found interesting. So I started by looking at Bill Shine, as I said, to try to take a look at the relationship between Fox and the White House. And what I found were there were all these different layers of relationships that go all the way up to the chairman of 21st Century Fox, who is Rupert Murdoch, one of the great moguls in the media world. And he has a very close relationship with President Trump. It's not always a happy relationship, but the two of them appear to speak regularly, maybe every week, some say every day. And Rupert Murdoch also speaks quite regularly, as much as daily, with President Trump's son-in-law, Jared Kushner. So you've got these very close relationships going on.
So you also report that Fox killed a story because they wanted Donald Trump to win and become president. And they killed the story at a time when Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump were kind of neck and neck in the polls. And the story has to do with Stormy Daniels. Explain the story that Fox News killed.
So this was in October 2016, and so right before the election, and a reporter at FoxNews.com had the story of the fact that the president was using his lawyer to pay off a porn star with whom the president had had an affair, and that they were trying to silence this porn star Stormy Daniels by paying her off, and that there was an actual contract which the reporter saw. And so the reporter, whose name is Diana Falzone, first caught wind of this in March, and she had been reporting all the way up through October, and she was pushing to get her story in print or on the website at Fox, and she kept getting a runaround from her editors there. Eventually, she was getting more and more frustrated and worried. The election was approaching. She thought it was something voters should at least be able to consider. And she reached the editor in charge of the website, a man named Ken LaCourte. And according to what she told her friends and colleagues at the time, and I've interviewed them, Ken LaCourte said to her, "Good reporting, kiddo, but Rupert Murdoch wants Donald Trump to win, so just leave it alone." And that was the end of the story. It was shelved.
So another related story that she broke and that Fox did not put on the air was that the Inquirer was doing catch and kill stories with other women who had had sexual relations or alleged that they had sexual relations with the president. And catch and kill, again, is when a tabloid buys the exclusive rights to a story with the intention of never publishing it, effectually killing the story. So Fox didn't go with that either. What was their reason for that?
It's all of a piece, basically, which was that what she was hearing was that Fox did not want to stand in the way of Trump getting elected president. In fact, it wanted to help him get elected president. And the word she was getting was this came straight down from the top from Rupert Murdoch. She was a young reporter. Not long after that, she was demoted. She eventually filed suit. And as part of the suit, she had to sign a non-disclosure agreement where she's not allowed to tell this story.
So how did you get it?
I spoke with her lawyer, who said she couldn't comment, but she confirmed that there was such a settlement. And I spoke with a friend in which the reporter confided. And I also confirmed it with someone she was working with at the time, who's quoted by name in the story. His name's Nick Ritchie. And interestingly, he was somebody who ran a kind of a gossip blog site in Hollywood. And he is a Trump supporter, and he is a fan of Fox News. But nonetheless, he said, Diana Falzone had the story. She did her homework. And he said to me, I told her Fox would never run it. But he also said he thought that it would have swayed the election if she'd been able to get it out there.
So at the risk of perhaps stating the obvious, what does it say that Fox News is alleged to have killed a story because it would hurt Trump's chances of winning the presidency?
Well, I mean, put it this way, it makes it not a regular news organization, not like any I've ever worked for specifically. And it makes it, what its critics say is that Fox is an arm of the White House. It's a mouthpiece for Trump.
Let's get back to the relationship between Rupert Murdoch, the chairman of Fox News, and President Trump. Their relationship goes back to 1975, when Murdoch bought the New York Post, the tabloid in New York, and Murdoch and Trump were brought together by Rory Cohn, who had been something of a mentor to Trump and is most famous for having been Senator McCarthy's chief counsel during the witch hunt for communists and communist sympathizers. So what did Cohn see as the potential synergy by bringing Murdoch and Trump together?
He thought that there was a great kind of deal that these two could strike, where Trump would grow famous, get celebrity from the New York Post. His exploits could run on page 6, the gossip section of the New York Post. And Trump was kind of a famous playboy, and it would you know, raise his public image. And Rupert Murdoch, who was just really launching page 6 at the New York Post, would have great copy, could sell copies of his paper and make money off the thing. So that was sort of the origin of the relationship between these two men. And as you say, it goes way back to the 70s.
You also write that in private at that time, Murdoch regarded Trump with disdain, seeing him as a real estate huckster and a shady casino operator. As I read that line, I was trying to imagine Trump reading this article and reading that line. If he didn't know that in private, Murdoch had regarded him that way, I think their relationship is better now. But still, you don't know the answer to that, I'm sure, but it sure made me wonder.
Well, you know, the thing is that Trump, from what I understand, and I did, you know, tons of reporting for this piece, Trump knows that Rupert Murdoch has often disparaged him behind his back, and that Rupert Murdoch loves to dine out on stories about inane things that Trump has said, and Rupert Murdoch shares it with his friends at dinner parties. And Michael Wolff, in his book on the Trump White House, actually quoted Murdoch as describing Trump as a expletive deleted idiot. And so certainly President Trump knows that Rupert Murdoch is not always worshipful of him. But what I was told was that Trump is okay with it, he has made his peace with that. And I think in part it's also because Trump really needs Murdoch. Trump really needs Fox. And Murdoch is an incredibly powerful figure in the media world at this point. And his audience is the Trump base.
So in 1996, Rupert Murdoch hires Roger Ailes to create Fox News. And then Trump starts making regular appearances in 2011. And you write a little bit about how that changed things at Fox News.
Yeah, so when Trump was asked on, one of the first things he started talking about in 2011 was this birtherism issue, challenging whether or not President Obama was authentically born in America. And it was an issue that had been kicking around on the fringes of American politics. But even the hosts at Fox, Bill O'Reilly and Glenn Beck at the time, who both had shows then, both of them thought it was an idiotic subject, and they had kind of knocked the whole idea of it as ridiculous. But when Trump comes on Fox, he starts pushing it, and Fox gives him a national platform to push it. And you begin to hear Sean Hannity pick up on it, too. So you begin to see the beginnings of what was going to be the later kinds of issues that Trump pushed in his own campaign.
Have you been watching a lot of Fox News while reporting
so
the
much.
Piece?
Mm-hmm. So much Fox News. So for morning, day, and night.
For people who aren't watching Fox News, what are some of the counter-narratives Fox News is offering?
Well, it's like an alternative universe. I hadn't realized till I really started watching it so much how completely different the narrative is on Fox. But it explains a lot about what's going on in American politics. I would recommend people take a look at it because you'll understand much better. What it's got going on is kind of an explanation and an argument for why everything that you see on the mainstream media is wrong. And so the basic storyline is that Robert Mueller's investigation is the witch hunt that Trump talks about, that this deep state is trying to push a coup in the country to push out Trump, that all the investigations into Trump are corrupt, and that the law enforcement agencies that are undertaking them, the FBI or whatever, that they're the crooks rather than Trump and the people around him. It's just a completely opposite viewpoint from what you would get in most of the other news organizations.
Is Fox News still advocating for further investigation into Hillary Clinton and her email server?
It is, but I get the feeling that may be losing a little bit of juice. But even as of a week or two ago, they were still saying, I think it was Sean Hannity was saying, that if the Justice Department doesn't open an investigation into Hillary Clinton, the Constitution will be shredded. So it's that kind of thing that you're going to see on Fox News still. And many other kind of odd conspiracy theories that sort of explain away any kind of criticism of Trump.
There are several people who have gone from Fox News into the Trump administration. Some of them have left the administration. But can you talk a little bit about that cross-pollination?
Yeah, there's almost a revolving door there. You've got, and in other administrations, to be fair, there have been People who've gone from news organizations to go work in White Houses before. You know, we think of, you know, Jay Carney, for instance, went from Time Magazine to go work in the Obama White House. But what you see in the Trump White House that's a little different is that many of the people who were talking heads on Fox are assuming important positions of all sorts, not just press positions.
Can you give us some examples?
Sure. So you've got John Bolton, who's now the National Security Advisor, and he had come from Fox. You've got Ben Carson, who's now the Secretary of Housing and Urban Development. He came from Fox. You've got the Deputy National Security Advisor, who also came from Fox. You had the Ambassador to the United Nations, Heather Nauert, who was appointed by Trump, but she didn't get confirmed. She withdrew herself, but she was also a talking head on Fox. These are all very complicated positions, major positions in an administration. They're not just press kinds of positions. And there just seems to be one after another there. And you also see people going from the Trump administration back onto Fox. So you would see Sebastian Gorka, who was in the Trump administration's National Security Council. And until just a couple days ago, he was very often on Fox as a supposedly independent commentator. Another example is Hope Hicks, who was the White House communications director and now has become the top communications director for 21st Century Fox.
Lou Dobbs, who hosts a show on Fox News and is very anti-immigration, you say he's been patched into Oval Office meetings. And he's a host on Fox News.
Exactly. I mean, some of the people who are the still hosting shows on Fox are seen by many of the people who are in and around the White House, including some of the White House staff, as basically being a shadow cabinet. So you've got Lou Dobbs being patched in to Oval Office meetings, and the same thing with Sean Hannity, who's got a kind of a uniquely powerful role in the White House, so much so that people refer to him as the shadow chief of staff.
They talk frequently after Hannity's show, right?
Hannity's told people that he and President Trump speak almost every night after Hannity's show.
That's a very unusual relationship, isn't it?
I've never heard of anything like it in any other White House. I mean, there've been in past White Houses there've been favored members of the press, but nothing where someone is so close in that they are coordinating on a daily basis with the president.
You report that Donald Trump was tipped off about a couple of key questions in the debates. What were those questions, and how was he tipped off?
So this is a report that's based on several Fox insiders, two who suggest that they have the information from an eyewitness who saw Roger Ailes tip off Trump prior to the big Republican presidential debate in 2015. It was August 2015, where Trump was, you know, all eyes were on Trump to see whether he could sort of hold his own. And he was given a famously tough question by Fox host Megyn Kelly, who asked him about his the way he had disparaged women and supposedly mistreated women. And it was a very tough question. And Trump handled it quite well. He broke the audience up in laughter with a quick one-line rejoinder where he said the only women that he spoke poorly of was just Rosie O'Donnell. And the hall just blew up in laughter. Everybody thought that it was an example of how Trump could think quickly on his feet and occasionally flash some charm and survive almost any kind of assault from the press. But according to a couple people I interviewed who were insiders at Fox, and in addition, somebody in the Trump campaign, they say that Trump had gotten advance notice of this question.
Is the implication that maybe somebody helped him come up with the Rosie O'Donnell rejoinder?
Or that maybe he'd rehearsed it. I mean, it's hard to know. I don't have that from anyone saying mm-hmm. that they specifically know that, but several people say that Roger Ailes was overheard telling Trump himself that he should get ready for that question.
You know, in talking about leaking debate questions to Donald Trump, when Donna Brazile, who'd been a Democratic operative, was also working with CNN and was, I think, working as a commentator then, she leaked questions to the Hillary Clinton campaign that were going to be asked on the debate. What did candidate Trump have to say when he learned that?
Oh, I mean, he has used it as a reason to sort of flog CNN as fake news and unfair and all of that sort of thing. So, I mean, there's certainly an irony if it really does turn out that he was given the answers himself in advance. Excuse me. It's really an irony if it does turn out he, too, was given questions in advance.
And you say that sources have told you it wasn't CNN who leaked those questions.
It was not CNN. Supposedly, Donna Brazile got the questions from a different source. And she was actually put through a very tough interview with Megyn Kelly afterwards, the Fox host, and kind of raked over the coals for it. So the whole thing looks quite ironic in retrospect.
So what does that say about Fox News? I mean, if what you're reporting is true, what ethics did the Fox News people break by leaking this to Trump?
Well, I mean, if it's a form of cheating, basically. It's putting a thumb on the scale for one candidate in particular. And it's engaging in politics, not journalism. I mean, there's supposed to be a line between being the press and being part of somebody's campaign. And in the past, actually, it's interesting to me that Fox has laid down that line as recently as 2010. I mean, Fox has always been a partisan network. It was founded to be a kind of a conservative alternative to the mainstream media, but a journalistic operation. It had its own motto, which was fair and balanced. But it's changed according to a number of people. And what I was saying was, as recently as 2010, it laid down the line and reprimanded Sean Hannity for crossing it. Sean Hannity was going to appear on the stage doing a fundraiser for the Tea Party, and he got in a lot of trouble for doing that. And Roger Ailes said, "We're not shilling for the Tea Party or any other party." And Rupert Murdoch himself said, "I don't think we should be supporting any party, including the Tea Party." And they kind of hung Hannity out there for doing it. But when he crossed that line again in 2016, Fox just issued a very kind of limp statement, and it seems like there were sort of no repercussions.
Well, what was the line that he crossed?
Well, so in the very end of the midterm campaign, right the night before the election, there was a grand final rally, and Sean Hannity was called onto the stage by Donald Trump, and he hopped up there and joined Trump and was praising him as if he was a member of the Trump campaign himself. And not only did he praise Trump standing up there with him, but then he castigated the other members of the press, calling them fake media. And that actually even included reporters from Fox News. So there was a huge hullabaloo within the press where reporters felt like that line had been crossed. But Fox really didn't seem to, it issued a very sort of milquetoast reprimand and moved on.
Toward the end of the piece, you write about how Fox News has been preparing for the release of the Mueller report. And a guest on Laura Ingraham's show, Joseph DeGenova, who's a lawyer who's been a frequent guest over the years on Fox News, he said, "It's going to be total war. And as I say to my friends, I do two things. I vote and I buy guns."
That's right. And I think, you know, that it's potentially very dangerous the way that Fox has torqued up anger in the base to try to suggest that if law enforcement were ever to close in on President Trump, that they should do something like take to the streets and maybe even turn to violence. I mean, it's an extraordinary situation to have the single largest cable news operation in the country airing those kinds of sentiments.
So in your reporting for your New Yorker story on Fox News and the Trump administration, you spoke to several people who had been a part of Fox News in various capacities, whether it's like working behind the scenes as a, you know, producer or booker or somebody who, you know, people who had been commentators on there. What are some of the things you learned from them, from people who were really, you know, insiders and who are conservative?
What was interesting was a number of them are unhappy with the direction that Fox has taken. I mean, they feel that Fox has become too much a mouthpiece for President Trump, that it's no longer conservative, and they worry that it's giving a platform for kind of authoritarianism. And so, you know, you have people in this story that were on the record, people like Bill Kristol, who is conservative, but he is a critic of President Trump's. And he used to be a contributor to Fox News, but he is no longer. He no longer has a contract with them. And he says it's changed a lot, and he feels that it's really becoming propaganda.
Jane Mayer, it is always a pleasure to talk with you. Thank you so much, and thank you for your reporting.
Well, it was great to be with you. Thanks, Terry.
Jane Mayer is a staff writer for The New Yorker. Her new article is titled The Making of the Fox News White House. Our interview was recorded Wednesday. Fresh Air Weekend is produced by Teresa Madden. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shurrock, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, Heidi Simon, Mooj Zaidi, Thea Chaloner, and Seth Kelly. Molly C.V. Nesper is our associate producer of digital media. I'm Terry Gross.